It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I'm delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
Hi, I'm Mary Kay.
And I'm Louise.
And together we are Novel Gazing, the podcast that talks literary fiction. We are recording today's show on April 28th. So again, if anything juicy happens between now and then, we're not ignoring it. It just hasn't happened to us yet. And on today's show, we're discussing current affairs as usual and news as usual from the literary fiction world. And we're going to talk about crossover genres as well as our current reads. It has also come to my attention that a few episodes ago, on the episode of literary fiction versus genre fiction, I came in pretty hot and came off pretty elitist about literary fiction. It also seems like I did not clarify enough that my opinion is, of course, super subjective, and that just because I prefer one genre over another does not make it better or worse. So I wanted to make sure that to do that here at the top of the episode, mm-hmm. and as a gesture of goodwill and hopefully to kind of undo that error, this episode's topic will be crossover hits, so to speak, meaning we're going to name some of our favorite literary genres, literary genres that are also other genres like YA, romances, horror, and what else, Louise?
I think we throw in a couple of randoms, right, just to keep everyone on their toes.
Yeah, I like that
idea. Sounds like a plan. Yeah.
Okay, but before we get into that, let's hear from one of our sponsors.
It's happening, readers. We have heard that you want paperbacks from our tailored book recommendation service called TBR. And I am delighted to let you know that we're going to be in sync with your request. That's right. We're bringing paperbacks. Whether you hate carrying around bulky hardcovers, you're on a budget, you want a wider range of recommendations, or all of the above, now you can get a paperback subscription from TBR curated just for you by one of our bibliologists. Get all the details at mytbr.co. That's mytbr.co. We're bringing paperbacks.
All right, so let's open up with some news and current affairs. And I think the first one we wanted to talk about was an article on how authors find their characters speak. And this is one you came across, right, Mary Kay?
Yes, so I found this one actually this morning. And I think Book Riot posted it independently of me finding it as well. So that makes me feel good that I have good taste. You know, like if Book Riot likes it, it's probably pretty solid. But I thought it was interesting because this study from The Guardian says that 63% of authors say they hear their characters speak while writing, with 61% reporting characters were capable of acting independently, which then that's a quote directly from the article. So I, as a writer, find it odd that the characters will act independently.
Yeah, it's something I've not had for sure.
I mean, I definitely do hear my characters' voices in my head, and I'm wondering if, because I'm write mostly historical nonfiction that's not historical, like they're actual people. So I went, and part of what this article says too is like, you're basically, if you're creating a character, you're creating the persona of a person that lives in your head. Mm-hmm. Which is pretty normal. Like, I mean, I don't know about you, but I'll put on an outfit and hear my mother's voice in my head being like, "You need to put some color on your face with that." You know, like I can just predict her reactions. And I think like if you have a really in-depth character, which hopefully you do, you should be able to kind of hear their reactions as well. But that just seems like odd. They're independent.
Yeah, it's quite a traditional idea though, isn't it? You hear it a lot in creative writing teaching, in authors talking about their stuff, that they do have these characters moving independently. I know the big one for me with the research doing is people like Enid Blyton and things like that, who say, oh, they are almost like telling the story on behalf of the characters, and they really are just kind of like a conduit for it.
Yeah, I totally buy that. And I know that on my part, like, my first book is about America's first female serial killer. So when her voice came into my head, that was pretty disturbing for me. Uh-huh. So a lot of the book is written from like the perspectives of other characters, because that, first of all, is just like more authentic, because she didn't have much of a voice in that time period. But also because it, depending on your characters, right? Like, you don't want them in your head.
I can imagine not with serial killers. Yeah, I can imagine that's an issue.
Right. Oh, she was, yeah, actually yeah. packed with issues.
Yeah, not, don't want that.
Yeah, and then just to kind of pack on, like, or like, not pack on, but like support what I was trying to say, one of the quotes from this article says that internal dialogue or inner speech is a phenomenon that people experience in many different ways. With some people including the voices of people they know as a part of their verbal thinking. And I think that part of that is how impressionable you are, like, or maybe even it's a part of empathy. I don't know the reasons why, that's just like what, that the article didn't say that. That's just me adding to it. And then the article goes on to say, whether or not we're always aware of it, most of us are trying to anticipate what other people are going to say and do and in everyday interactions. And for some of these writers, it might be the case that after a while, their characters start to feel independent because the writers develop the same kinds of personality models as they develop for real people. And these were generating the same kinds of predictions. So that makes it sound a little bit less like a disorder, and a little more of like you did your due diligence with creating these characters. But I just thought that that was, the article is super interesting, because I read the title and I was like, oh my gosh, that's horrifying. And then I read it and I was like, no, this is regular, like I have this all the time. So I don't know.
No, yeah,
what do you think?
It's interesting because it's kind of trying to understand creativity, isn't it, in a really particular sense, and kind of box it and almost find the patterns that make these stories and these narratives happen. But I think as well, it is about patterns, actually, in that we are human. We understand how a conversation works. We look for hello, and then, you know, you reply with, oh, great, hello, or like, how are you? I'm fine, thank you. We fill in and we look for the call and response, the thing that finishes off the thing that has been given us. So in some senses, I think it's almost filling in those patterns just but by yourself, because there's no one else here when you write. It's like you've got to, I don't know, sit in the dark and angrily type at the laptop for months on end.
When you said that, it made me think of, like, so, you know, I don't know if this has happened to y'all, but this happened to me a lot in, like, middle or high school, where as soon as I left a conversation, I would think of the perfect thing to say.
Oh, that's the worst.
And then, it's the worst. And then I was like, well, that is not going to happen to me again. So I would, like, play the conversation out in my head so that next time I would be ready. And I did that a lot.
The worst.
I, like, I still do it, but I was an only child. So, I mean, I spent a lot of time with my own imagination.
The worst part is when you get the perfect response about 6 months after the event. And you're like, yes, I finally know what to say to this situation.
Yeah, or you realize like 5 years later that this person you had a crush on was actually hitting on you. Mm. You just didn't know it at the time. And it's like, oh, I'm stupid. Yeah. Like, what would I
do? These sudden moments of revelation.
But then you, you know, you right, you workshop that moment in your head and play it out. And sometimes I think that that's how people in general kind of develop the persona that they want to display to the world, because you're like kind of creating that character, like, this is how I want to come across, but yourself.
Well, that in
it's just interesting.
Yeah, sorry, we're going on a slight tangent here, so just forgive us for a moment, but what really stuck with me from what you've just said there is I remember a lecture that I went to, and the guy sort of basically said, how many yous, as in Y-O-U, not as in sheep, how many yous are you a you too? So his point was, how many different versions of yourself do you present the world, and how many different versions of, I don't know, if your name is like Sarah Jones, how many different Sarahs does the world know? And it's all about like the identity that you present and you show the versions of yourself to someone, I think.
Oh, totally. Mm. I agree with that. And we kind of talked about that on our episode about literary nonfiction too.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, not only, I mean, I might have been Chekhov, I can't remember now, who said the dullest actual person is more interesting than the most interesting character. So to think that you're writing about yourself, or, you know, creating a character, it's still only a fraction of what you would know of another person. So,
we need to do a special just on this, I think, at some point.
We can. I mean, probably, or we'll just end up like thinking about it.
I know.
Just be like radio silence.
About 6 months later, we will have to do a follow up and just go, guys, right, we figured it out.
Right,
now.
That's how long we need to workshop the conversation.
Yeah. So, all right.
Man. Yeah.
God.
Let's talk about your find of news.
All right, yeah. So the Comedy Women in Print Prize 2020 long list is out. And this is funny women writing funny things. And it's a brilliant long list. It features published and unpublished comic fiction and graphic novels by women writers. And I will include the link in the show notes.
Of course.
And the picks of the long list for me were Queenie by Candice Carty Williams, which is, it's one of those books that got labelled as a Fleabag similar title, which I kind of think...
Love it.
Yeah. I mean, I was a bit hit and miss with Fleabag. It never really hit home for me. So I kind of want these books to be understood in their own right. But Queenie is brilliant.
Sure.
So I think post-breakup life in London... touching on mental health, touching on real world social rights movements like the Me Too movement, and it's really funny and smart.
So it has like a similar content.
Yeah, I think it's just young women living messy, honest lives.
Well, I can identify with that.
Like solidarity here for the pair of us, yeah.
Right.
And in many senses, there's not many ways for people to understand that without popping the Fleabag label onto them.
Yeah, and I think also people who publicize are like, here's another popular thing where if you liked it, you'll probably like this as well.
Yeah, it's the shorthand. So go for Queenie, I think, is brilliant. But, and as you all know, I've recommended comics on here before because I think they're a really excellent route into literary fiction and a brilliant, valid form of literary fiction in their own right. So I'm going to pick Sensible Footwear, A Girl's Guide, which is a graphic guide to lesbian and queer history between 1950 and 2020 by Kate Charlesworth. And it is so good. It's a mammoth task to try and encapsulate that amount of history in a comic. And she does it so brilliantly and so beautifully and so... kindly, I think. I really want like more kindness in the stuff I read, you know, like where people realize that the mistakes they make and the mistakes that are made are just part of being human in a sense. So yeah, Sensible Footwear, I really recommend it.
So I love this title.
It's so
it's
clever.
Amazing. I have a question. Because I have not read this but definitely want to, and I'm just trying to into like manage my expectations, I suppose. Does it How much does the footwear play into it? Is it like an ethnography of shoes?
No, so it's like it's a pun, in some senses that the are playing on. I don't know if the expression translates into over America, but there's an idea that if you wore comfy shoes, you had a particular sexuality. So I think it's playing on that and messing around with that and just saying, actually, this is the history of the people that stand behind such a trite and inappropriate expression. And here's the story of what they had. And so it touches on, it's UK history, just to clarify. So it touches on things like the Section 28 thing, which hit my education. I was never taught about lesbian and queer history in any sense whatsoever, because it was illegal. So it's remarkable to think how far we've come, and yet how far we still have to go in many senses. And Kate Charlesworth just kind of encompasses all that in such a strong, powerful, brilliant and incredibly funny manner that it's a book that I would give to you in a heartbeat.
Okay. I mean, that does not deter me from wanting to read it even a little. I was just, you know, trying to conceptualize it in my head. Also, I think that does transfer, but it might, that phrase does transfer, but it might be a little bit less on the nose here. Because I was like, I get that it's a joke, like a kind of, I mean, in this context, but yeah, thank you for clarifying for me. Also, 70 years is such a long time.
It's amazing.
It's amazing.
I just, you just kind of think, wow, you've done this. And even that, even if you've done it poorly, to still do it is a massive achievement in its own right. But to deliver a book that is as good as this and as truthful and as beautiful as this, it's a great thing.
I'm excited for it.
Excellent.
So are those two the ones that you hope win?
Yeah, I'd go for those two. But I think anything on the long list is really great. There's work there by some brilliant women writers. And, you know, anywhere on there, you would not go wrong. We will, as I say, include the link, but we'll also give you the link to the Twitter so you can follow them and gain some more background information on the titles and the writers. And hopefully it gives a bit more of an open world.
Oh, I'm excited for that. Cool.
Fab.
Thank you.
All right. Shall we pause for a moment from our sponsors?
Oh, yes.
Fab.
So, let's talk about some crossover hits. It came to my attention while I was listing my favorite YA books to talk to Louise about that, well, they're not YA. And that might be the reason why I don't, I mean, like, I have no informed opinion about this because I didn't really understand what qualified a book as being part of that genre. So, Louise, will you please define what a young adult genre book is?
All right. Yeah, I felt really bad because I was just kind of going, that's not young adult. That's not young adult. I'm really sorry.
I'm so glad you did because, I mean, how else would I learn?
Well,
you
know, so
if nobody ever told me.
So the first thing is that young adult isn't a genre. It's a collection of books that came around essentially in a post-World War II context. If you think that teenagers clearly existed before this, but they weren't ever quite understood. In this way that we understood them after the war. And a lot of this comes from the radicalism of post-World War II publishing, especially for children and for young adults. People were thinking that children were the people that were going to get them out of these problems. There were two world wars, everything had gone wrong, the world had been reshaped and vastly impacted over several years. And children, it's a hackneyed phrase, but children were the future. So the books that they were given by the adults that were involved in publishing, and they were particularly intended to be liberal, radical, to move them towards a place where they could make the choices and to not repeat that which had come before. So then coming into the 70s and the 80s, when all those kids who'd grown up in the post-war context, who'd read those mm-hmm. books, we'd had things like Elvis, rock and roll, the Beatles, the idea of a youth culture mm-hmm. being really formed. And then in the 80s, these people were kind of adults working in publishing and making the next generation steps, so to speak, in able to find a young adult canon. And this is where most of the big, big initial books start to make themselves known. People like Robert Cormier, Judy Blume, sort of late 80s, 90s, Paula Danziger, people like that. These are stories that were concerned with young adult characters doing young adult things. So not mm-hmm. necessarily like a child or an adult. Right. It's that space in between, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay, see, listeners, y'all are going to see real quick that I didn't know that. Because the books that I listed are none of them qualify for that definition. Also, I just referred to it as a genre, and you were real quick to be like, no. So yeah. Thank you. Thank you for that.
It's a common thing, though. A lot of people can read young adult as a genre and say, okay, it is a genre of books. And it's like, well, no, it's not. It's a type of fiction that can be mm-hmm. represented in science, fiction, historical, any sort of type of genre can be considered as a young adult book, providing it has these kind of loose criteria of the mm-hmm. usually a juvenile central character that dealing with teenage young adult concerns, and mm-hmm. they are recognisably different from children and from adults. They're that thing,
right?
That messy in between, right?
Right. So, like, the ones that I listed, y'all, were To Kill a Mockingbird, not YA, because she's a child and it takes place in the 30s. So, immediately out.
Not for that sense. In one sense, you could say that To Kill a Mockingbird is a young adult novel, but it's not, because it's written from the adult perspective.
Got it.
So, okay. She looks back onto her childhood and reflects upon that. So the young adult novel, it clearly existed in some sense before we started referring to it as the young adult novel.
Right, before we had a name.
Yeah.
Okay.
But okay. With To Kill a Mockingbird, it's because Scout has her mature reading of it. So she is an mm-hmm. adult as she's reflecting and retelling the story. And mm-hmm. there is a really interesting article on Book Riot that will pop into the links as well, that talks mm-hmm. specifically about whether To Kill a Mockingbird can be young adult, and I think it has I think it has certain young adult resonance for sure, so I can see why you pull it in, but mm-hmm. technically I would probably step back from saying it is a young adult novel, because I just don't think it is.
Okay. I'll buy that. I have no frame of reference, so it can be a good book and still not fit into that category. I forgot about Judy Blume. I do like Judy Blume.
God, love Judy Blume. She is legendary, even though for many of my generation, particularly from British school days, we were very confused with how the sanitary towels and the period thing worked. Mm. Like, they wore sanitary belts, and we were like, what is mm-hmm. that? What? How does that work?
Right. It is, man, just, for so long, they just didn't acknowledge that that was a problem that needed solved.
Yeah. Well, it's you've got to think, like, Judy Blume is revolutionary in her way for featuring this sort of thing in her books. Like, mm-hmm. the Victorians or something, children just kind of magically shifted from about 6 years old to about 19 and getting married.
Right.
And there was nothing in between.
Right, you were a child, and then you were a mom, and then you were dead.
And that's it, right?
Yeah. I mean, pretty much.
Look forward to that, guys.
You know, right. Okay, so the others, I'm just going to go ahead and get these out of the way, if that's all right.
Oh, my love.
Because none of these are accurately YA. Phantom Tollbooth? Nope. That's child's fantasy. All Roald Dahl? Also no. I put in Uncle Remus, but I don't think those are either. I think those are a totally different, amazing, problematic oral history. And then I put in The Wizard of Oz, and I was, and that's also a no. That's children's lit and fantasy, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So that led me to maybe the conclusion that maybe I just did not have a young adulthood. Like, it seems like I have no authority at all, because I wasn't even aware of what YA entailed.
I think, though, in some sense, we can sort of say that, and this is also to readers who might have had, other readers that might have had a similar journey, in that it's never too late to start reading these books.
Sure.
Because you have, you know, I am still working out the world massively, and I'm like 102. So these books still have an immense cultural resonance. And if you are wanting places to start, we can provide those. And, you know, my picks would be I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith, who was the author of the 101 Dalmatians.
Okay.
And I Capture the Castle, it's possibly the most perfect young adult novel you might read in some senses, in that it has an eccentric family. The opening line is, I write this sitting in the kitchen sink. And it's so beautifully and so vividly romantic and unreal and strange that if you haven't been towards these books before, and if you're not sure where to begin, then, you know, I Capture the Castle by Dodie Smith is a perfect place to start.
Okay. Noted. Added to list.
Let's all read it. I would be very happy if just everyone just reads I Capture the Castle for like the next 6 weeks. That'll make my day.
Okay. Great.
All right.
Good book club.
And the other stuff I was thinking of as well was some other authors that are brilliant and give you crazy, wild, big stories that kind of find the edge of the universe and find the elasticity in it and that push it open for you and say you can be part of this world. So the other book that I would recommend, again, as doing something like this, is a book called Life, An Exploded Diagram, and it's by Mal Pete, who has now sadly passed away. But the books that he wrote before this were stunning. They are almost unclassifiable, yet they tell you everything about the world and what you can be within it. And so Life, An Exploded Diagram is, at one sense, it's a love story, at one sense, it's a history lesson. And it's so strange and so big, it's a brilliant piece of writing.
It sounds good, and it's a great title.
Yeah, it's really great. Don't know, should I give my third here, or do you think?
Yeah, do it.
All right, so I wanted to pick a couple of examples of authors from across the time period, so a couple of, like, a historical one, and then I wanted to pick someone really recent and present. And that is an author called Juno Dawson, who is a UK young adult writer of fierce talent. And she shifts across genre. She's done stuff like a contemporary point horror type vibe through to Margot and Me, which is a book about a relationship between a girl and her grandmother and her finding out actually what's going on with her grandmother and why she is what she is. And Juno Dawson is so skilled at hopping between these stories and yet telling the truth about teenage life, in that it is complicated, but you are not alone in experiencing this. You are with friends, you are with people,
mm-hmm.
and the choices that you make are totally valid and you have the right to make them. She has a lovely eye for youthful life. God, that sounds cool. So ancient. Youthful life. So if you can cope with, like, a granny telling you this, I really recommend, yeah, Juno Dawson's my final sort of big pick, any of her work, but particularly I think Margot and Me is one of the best.
Okay. I thought of one.
Go for it.
Okay. So when I was, I did an AmeriCorps program tutoring kids who had mental illness, And what that meant for me, and I have a point in telling y'all this, I promise. What that meant for me is like a lot of the kids who are like 14 to 18, so young adults, just didn't really trust adults because they didn't have any who were reliable in their lives. And so I was supposed to tutor them in literacy. So I brought in The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton.
Yep, yep.
And I set it down on the table, and I just thought of another one, too, that I read with them. And I was trying to get this one kid to read it, and he just was not into it. And another kid, one of the older ones, came by, and he goes, oh, The Outsiders? This book go hard. Because it was so resonant, you know, with them, because it is like, it has to do with gangs. I mean, granted, like, this is in the 50s, so they look different than they do now. But it was just like that quick endorsement of like an older young adult made the kid I was trying to read with be like, yes, okay, let's do it. So I thought about that one. And then on a similar note, because I'm wondering now, like, maybe I didn't have a young adulthood and that's why I don't identify with that genre in the past. I haven't in the past. But would you count Holes?
Ooh. I would probably say it's upper children's, but then again, that's really like, because I work in the industry and it's a really picky thing. And I do think at some point you have to kind of go, all right, who is this book talking to and who is this book resonating with? But yeah, I'd probably say young adult. It's kind of on the cusp.
Okay.
So I will allow it.
Okay. I was thinking like as you know, I was recalling it. I was like, but I think I read that with a 13-year-old, so I'm not sure if it'll count.
Yeah.
I mean, I read it on my own as well, but I didn't remember it as well as when I was reading it with him because kind of looking back on it, I could... That novel is so tight. Like, it's just everything comes back in. Same with The Outsiders. Like, it is just... They're both very well done, and I think that they're both... quote unquote literary as we loosely defined it in episode 0-2. And I'm not saying that the ones that you picked weren't, of course, I just haven't read those. And of course I trust your judgment over, especially over mine. But yeah, I have some holes in my knowledge, of course. And I just wanted to tell y'all listeners that I probably need the Read Harder Challenge a lot more than I thought. And, by the way, I've been using the spreadsheet that The Amazing Tirza made, which we'll link to, which is kind of a reading log, but it also tells you, like, where you've been reading at, like, if you've been reading mostly female or male or non-binary authors. Like, it's just a really cool way of seeing what your comfort zone is. And there's another toggle that goes to the Read Harder Challenge that when I started this spreadsheet in January, I was like, well, I'm going to do this, too, just to see... how, you know, if I am reading as diversely as I thought. And I have completed 8 out of the 24 of the challenges, which is, I've never been good at 8 times tables, but that's a third, right?
It's a propulsion.
Okay, so I'm a little behind, but I also haven't intentionally yet gone in and been like, okay, I need to read from this thing. But, I mean, the list is great. It's really cool. And it's specific in a way that I wouldn't think to look for, especially like out of my comfort zone. So it's cool. Okay, should we move into a different crossover hit subgenre? I don't even know how to say what I'm trying to say. Help me.
Romance. Okay. to some, let's go to romance.
Okay.
All right.
So you want to start? Or you want me to?
I can do. So, yeah. Where do you begin with romance? Because I think, for me, it begins in two words, and that is Eva Ibbotson.
Okay.
And she is an author that didn't really, from what I've been told and what I've talked with people, has never really fully translated over to the US market as much as she did here.
Okay.
She was a Jewish... her family was Jewish and they moved over to the UK in the 40s due to obviously the rise of Nazism, and she attended a very avant-garde school that I actually went to university at later, so it was really lovely. Cool. That connection. And she grew up to write these incredibly rich stories of eccentric, artistic, creative, unusual people falling in love with each other, even though one of them or both of them might not be aware of that happening. And she has buns in them, she has tea houses, eccentric aunts, and every inch of it is suffused with her Jewish heritage, and also her rich eye for detail. There's a line in one of them that I will never forget, and she talks about how one character scratches the ear of a dog, and she scratches him just in the precise part where a large dog keeps his soul. And I just thought, that's so beautiful to find that moment.
That is.
Yeah. And she's so right. It is just behind the ear of a big dog that you can just go, this is it. This is where you are precisely, perfectly, perfectly made. So, yeah.
Okay, so I have a question that I probably should have asked earlier. But how do you define if something is a romance?
Oh, I think if it just has the romantic element, you can have the straight sort of Mills and Boone type romance where you know very much where, when you pick it up, what you're getting into, right?
Mm-hmm.
Where it's packaged in a certain manner. It's perhaps part of a series. It's perhaps got certain rules about it. I know the Mills and Boone books are very specifically designed and structured and have certain elements about them that have to be in a certain manner. But
interesting.
Yeah, so you can have kind of straight pure romance, but equally romance is such it's a part of human life, isn't it? And it's everywhere. So
yeah.
I love it when you find it in places that you do not expect. So for me, the other book that I wanted to shout out for this moment was a book called A Little Love Song by Michelle Magorian. It's technically a young adult, and you should look for the UK version if you can. It was republished in the US in a slightly different form called Not a Swan, and has an extra weird plot element twist in it. It just doesn't work.
So that one's a double crossover hit.
Yeah, so it ticks both. Boom. So A Little Love Song. It's the book that I read when I need my heart making whole. Essentially, you know, when you are broke and depressed and everything is awful, I pick this book.
So it's a good one for right now, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, actually, yeah. So once you finish doing a Capture the Castle, if everyone would do A Little Love Song, and then just hit me up on Twitter and we can talk about it until the cows come home, I'd be very happy.
Wonderful. Yours sounds so wholesome compared to the ones that
I know. We are a show that embraces contrasts.
Okay, so one that I wanted, or one author that I felt, I didn't put it on the list, but of course, I don't know how I missed her, but Anais Nin.
Oh, yeah.
Was like, she's amazing. Yeah. I like the correspondences between her and Henry Miller, I think, the best. But I loved Rosalind Miles's Guinevere trilogy when I was in high school, because it retells the story of King Arthur, or like, you know, the whole mythology, which I was obsessed with at the time. And it does so where love and lust and attraction is really the motivations behind behind it, all of it. And I liked as well that it acknowledged that there was something going on with Lancelot for Arthur.
Yeah.
Which is, I feel like, revisionist-wise, pretty apparent. But at the time, it would have been like an Easter egg for if you knew, then you knew.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't. So I loved those. Also, of course, I love Anne Rice. Like, she is, I mean, I'm a horror person, but you can totally tell that she's a romance writer, even though she is most famous for her vampire series. And that Beauty series, it's another retelling of the fairy tale of Sleeping Beauty.
Okay.
Is kind of genius, honestly. Ooh. Like, it's pretty dope.
So I've never really gone to Anne Rice at all. So would you suggest that's a good place to start?
I think it depends because it definitely, even when she's writing romance of the limited cross section that I've read, it definitely still has the element of horror in it.
All right,
So
okay.
if that is not really your jam, maybe no. But if it is, maybe yes.
Just no.
Or just, give it a go. And then if you, this is what I do with books where I'm on the fence, like, I don't really like it, but I know who would like it, and then I give it to them. So that's always a way to do it. And you can support your booksellers at this precarious economic time as well. So if you're thinking
Yes.
about buying any of these books, go ahead on and do it, y'all.
We are pro that. Gosh, yeah.
Yeah.
So
So you go.
the last genre that we wanted to talk about was horror, right? And I know this
Yes.
is your specialty area, so do you want to hit us off?
Sure. I kind of define horror as loosely as I define literary, meaning that one of the main objectives is to scare you. So, that's just, I mean, that's again very loose, and of course anyone can have his their own opinion about it, so it's fine. But for like with the Beauty series with Anne Rice, it definitely has the romantic element, and it also is supposed to make you a little uncomfortable, I think.
All right.
So maybe not like outright scare you where you need to put the book in the freezer when you go to bed, but it should make you like a little bit spooked afterwards. So the scariest book that I've ever read, I definitely would consider literature. It's called The True Confessions of a Justified Sinner by James Hogg. And I thought that it was going to be super dry because I think I read it in 17th century literature, and he's Scottish.
I thought you were
And I
about
was
to
like,
say that,
oh
I read it
dear.
in the 17th century, and I'm thinking, how?
Yes, I'm 1,001
Well,
years
like,
old.
we're all about
But
sharing.
yeah, he's in Scotland, and or maybe it's the 1700s, actually, not the 17th century. My bad. So this is during a Calvinist Protestantism, in which predestination is a really big factor, but there's a group of that denomination that believes you can tell, or rather, a reverend can tell you whether or not you are predestined to go to heaven, and if you are, I mean, do whatever you want, right? Because you're in.
Oh.
So, which I don't think is the message of the book, but I do think it is a caution against that mentality, especially for that time period, because, and this is not spoiling anything, it happens in the first 20 pages of this book. One of the teenagers comes of age, and he has like a party, and then the reverend, his I think stepfather, decides that he is in the elect, which is what they call it. And that day after, or the next day after the party, when he is capable of making his own adult decisions, Satan shows up and is reading the Bible. And it's like, oh my God. Like, it's so scary, but it also has a deeper purpose of like, consider what you believe in. I think that's one of the messages that it tries to get across. And it was not dry at all. Like, I thought it was going to be, just because of that time period is a layer of the English language that is just typically really hard for me to access, but it was so compelling. So that one, excuse me. And then Geek Love by Katherine Dunn is amazing. It's about, how to paraphrase this. Wow.
Go.
Listeners, if y'all have read this book, you're probably like, how is she going to do this? Because there's just so much in it. Essentially, a family of sideshow workers decides that they want to have children who all have anomalous bodies so that they can have basically a means of earning money built into their existence.
Oh my God.
So I know. So the mother and father do novelty acts. I think one of them is an acrobat and the other is maybe a mermaid. I can't remember. Like but it's a thing you can train yourself to do. Whereas a freak show, as it is called in the book, is typically a person with an anomalous body. So like an extra limb or something that at the time period would not have been thought of medical so much as like an omen. So the family decides that that's what they're going to do and dose themselves with something that that messes up their DNA. So that they have this family full of, I mean, I don't want to say disabled because they are abled in other ways, but it's just, it's very complicated, and it's told from one of the children's perspectives. So it's just, it's real good. It's real good and real scary. And it has the circus element, which is always a little spooky, or at least unnerving. It's fantastic. It truly is. And I know we were talking about like covers. It took me so long to read that book because the cover of the version that I kept seeing was just not very good. Like it didn't, I mean, I don't want to say not very good because it is, of course, well designed, but it didn't depict what was happening in the book on the cover.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
And I know you're not supposed to judge a book on its cover, but
we
I mean,
do.
You gotta start somewhere.
Yeah, we do.
But we do. Mm. Yeah.
All right.
So, yeah. Those are my two big horror literary reads. And, of course, Beloved. But I talk about that incessantly, so those are the two big ones.
You just say that as a given, that one, right?
Right, it is a given. Excellent. It's the best book.
All right, yeah. So for the horror stuff, I was like, I knew it was your kind of jam, so I'm thinking, okay, what can I bring to this? And I'm kind of gone down the route of the psychologically odd, unnerving type of stuff.
Love it.
So, love it. Yeah. So I've gone for a children's book called Marianne Dreams by Catherine Stahl. And it's a couple of decades old now. And it's about an ill girl who is bedridden from her illness. And as part of that, her mum gives her some crayons to work with. And the drawings that she makes, she starts entering them in her dreams. And it is so cool. It is so good. It's really incredibly weird and incredibly unnerving and incredibly dark for what it is and when it was. It's so unusual. So, Marianne Dreams. There's apparently a sequel to it that wasn't by any means as good. So stick with the first one. Mm-hmm. And be freaked out, and again, come and tell me all about it, because I am still thinking about that book.
Yes, yeah. Add to cart. Yeah. Get it. I mean, not while I was on the call, but immediately afterward, I will.
Yeah.
when I'm writing up the show notes.
Every now and then, like, British children's and young adult literature throws out these really unusual things that don't make any sense. They don't fit any genre. They don't fit any criteria. They just kind of are so resolutely of themselves, and I think Marianne Dreams is one of those books, and it's incredibly well done.
Awesome.
So yeah,
is it illustrated?
Yeah, so the
The
drawings that she does in the edition that I had, I think it's the same throughout, the edition that I had had these drawings come in, and you could see like what she made on the paper. And I don't know how anyone, when they first read it, when it first came out, ever drew anything again. Because I'd just be like, no.
I'm going to get sucked into it.
Yeah, I'm not having those crayons. I will just stare at the page from now on, because I think that's safer.
A blank page is good.
Yeah. So the last one that I thought is on a similar line, which is Black Narcissus by Ruma Godden. And there's a BBC adaptation of this, I think, coming soon. So keep your eyes out for that, because I'm really looking forward to it. Cool. And what it is it's a group of nuns are sent to establish a convent in India, in the Himalayas somewhere. And it doesn't go well. They're kind of affected by the area. They're kind of affected by the things that happen. Certain of them find their commitment to their religion incredibly challenged, and things go to a scary and unusual and complicated place. And it's not necessarily horror in, you know, ghouls and gremlins jumping out of the darkness at you, but it's more the things that lie in the back of your psyche finally making themselves known.
I cannot wait.
Oh, God.
I am so pumped for that.
I love the book so
much. You had me at nuns. Like, I'm ready.
Well, yeah. And the film is by Emmerich Powell. It's by Powell and Pressburger, a really iconic World War II mid-century filmmakers. And the film I really recommend as well. If you can't get out the book, get yourself towards the film. It's beautifully done and it's got a lot in it to think about. So I'm trying to be like as coy as I can without telling you everything.
Sure, yeah, you don't want to give too much
Yeah,
away.
But I think it's one of those books that you kind of think you understand it and then you put it down and you think, nah, there's so much more and I'm only just getting at it.
Yeah, that's how I was about the movie The Witch. Mm. I was like in the grocery store like 4 days later, just staring at the laundry detergent. Like, is that what that meant? Like, it just keeps unfolding. I love it. I can't wait. And is Black Narcissus a flower?
Yeah, the Narcissus is a flower. I don't know if it's a black now. I don't know if there's a black Narcissus. But yeah, there's certainly a yellow one. Plants aren't my specialty.
Okay. Me neither. Cool. Okay.
So yeah.
Ooh, I'm excited for this.
No, I know. We will come back to this kind of area and discussion in the future, I think, because there's still a lot more titles and a lot more things that we could have mentioned. But I think, if you hit us up with genres that we've missed or genres that you'd like us to talk about or things for the future that you want us to give you reading recommendations and a discussion on, then hit us up. We're more than happy.
Yeah, we can do a deep dive into any of these, or if we missed one, we love hearing from y'all about what you want us to address and all that. Or just tell us that you liked it or that... Well, I like less when you tell us that you don't, but of course I do. I
love. But tell us.
Still want to know though, because we're trying to improve.
But tell us if you've read "I'll Capture the Castle," because then I can fangirl with you over it all.
Yeah, I'm excited for that one too. I have at least three that I'm adding to my list.
I know, God.
Yeah. Oh, so what are you reading now, Louise?
So, I recently sold my first book. I got a book deal, which was kind of glorious. And I know, very exciting.
Oh my gosh, congratulations! Thank you. I'm so excited.
And as part of it, I bought myself, because I am nothing if not on brand, I bought myself some vintage picture books to celebrate. And I picked The Madeleine Treasury by Ludwig Bemelmans. And so for those of you...
I've been seeing you post about those.
Oh, they made me so happy. They're just so great. Beautiful. If you don't know Madeleine, she is a tiny girl who attends a convent school in Paris. There are 12 little girls in two little lines, and the smallest of them all is Madeleine.
Oh.
It's adorable, and she takes no grief. She's just tough and small and feisty, and the books are beautifully done. They were done by, I think Ludwig Bemelmans was a... New York reporter for the New Yorker.
Okay.
Yeah, so he's got a really strong, beautiful eye for detail. And so in this kind of eccentric story of this little girl storming her way around Paris, you get some classic sights and sounds of the images that she's around in. So you see like the Eiffel Tower, you see like the Champs-Élysées, you see this, that and the other, and it's just beautiful.
Oh, that's wonderful. Keep posting about it, please.
Oh, I will. I'm so obsessed with them. So, yeah, that's my treat.
Can you tell us about your book?
Oh, yeah. Sure. It's called How to Be Brave, and it features nuns and buns and convents, and there is a theme with my work at the moment. There really is.
I love it.
And a boarding school story, and it is due out in autumn 2021.
Wonderful. Oh, I'm so excited for you.
Oh, that's fun great. Times. Yeah, so what about your book? What are you reading?
Oh, okay, so I just started reading A Manual for Cleaning Women by Lucia Berlin.
Ooh.
And it's another collection of short stories, and I am really enjoying it so far because I can't remember if I've talked to you about it on here, but I'm really fascinated with the way people go about jobs that I don't want to say they're unappreciated, but like if you do them well, then people don't really notice.
Mm-hmm.
Like cleaning people.
Yeah.
You know? So I'm really enjoying that a lot.
Excellent.
It's very cool. Yeah.
Oh, that's good.
And it was recommended on Carmen Maria Machado's list, and I'm obsessed with her. So I've just been working my way through that list, and now I have some more to add to it. But yeah, I'm really liking that book a lot.
Oh, we're all going to be so busy when we get to go back into the libraries and the bookshops.
Oh yeah,
it's going to be so busy. Poor guys. All right, so yeah, I think that's it.
Okay, I'll sign this off. Thank you all so much for listening. Thank you to our sponsors who make this possible.
Thank you.
Listeners, don't forget to subscribe through however you like to get your podcasts. Tell your friends about us. And if you can, we would love it if you left us a review, because that helps other people find us. Where can they find you at specifically, Louise?
So you can find me at my website, which is didyoueverstoptothink.com. And I'm also at ChaletFan on Twitter.
Yay. And then you're going to keep posting about Madeline.
I am. Join me in Picture Book Nerdery.
Okay, good. And I'm Mary Kay. You can find me on MaryKayMcBrayer.com, but also on Twitter at MKMcBrayer and Instagram at MaryKayMcBrayer. So thank y'all again for listening, and
thank
we will talk to you soon. I think next time we're talking about doorstoppers, right?
Yes.
Like the big, thick books.
Yes.
Awesome. Okay, we'll talk to y'all soon.
Bye.
Thanks.